Hello, and welcome to the Matters of the Heart podcast, where I talk to interesting people about interesting things in cardiology. I'm your host, Dr. Rahul Mufalali. In this episode, I'm speaking to Dr. Sriram Rao about durable mechanical circulatory support devices in advanced heart failure, or MCS. Sri is a specialist in advanced heart failure and transplant, and he's just returned from the United States, where he's working at a really high-volume VAD and transplant center. And he's come back here to become the director of heart failure at the Victorian Heart Hospital and hopefully start a VAD center here in Victoria. It's amazing to see how much progress has happened in the last 20 years for patients with advanced heart failure. Using these devices has boosted survival for these patients from the single digits all the way up to 90% at 2 years. And many cardiologists, myself definitely included, are not overly familiar with these devices as they don't form part of our everyday practice. But as these devices improve, I think it is really important that we are all well-versed so that no eligible patients get missed, as these can really be life-changing devices, as you'll find out in this episode. Now, this is a longer podcast, but we cover a lot of ground, and I think it's really worth sticking through to get the lay of the land when it comes to ventricular assist devices and artificial hearts. Without further ado, I give you Dr. Sriram Rao on mechanical circulatory support. So, Sri, thanks for joining us. I'll give you a little bit of introduction before the start of this podcast, but why don't you tell us a bit about who you are and what you do in the cardiology space?
Yeah, so my name's Sri Rao. I'm the Director of Heart Failure here at the Victorian Heart Hospital, and I'm an advanced heart failure cardiologist by training. So initially trained here in Australia, was privileged to train in Sydney, first at Prince Alfred Hospital and then at St. Vincent's Hospital, which is the largest transplant program in the country. Before then having the opportunity to go over to America to further training and further education, did an advanced heart failure and transplant cardiology fellowship at the Hospital for the University of Pennsylvania, which is in Philadelphia, was then stayed on there to do some further research and then was on faculty there for a period of time before then transitioning to Washington, D.C. to Georgetown MedStar Washington Hospital Center, which is one of the largest left ventricular assist device or LVAD therapy centers in the country. It implants somewhere in the vicinity of between 70 and 100 LVADs a year, which for context, in Australia last year, there were 40 LVADs implanted for the entire country. Okay. And for context of the last decade in Australia, there has been about 300, a little bit under, about 250 LVADs implanted in the country in that period of time. And we implanted that over my 3-year tenure in DC. So it's a different scale and a different capacity, and then sort of did that for a while, loved what I did, and then ended up getting the opportunity to move back here to Australia to be able hopefully to bring some of that technology to what we can offer Australian patients here.
Yeah, it sounds like incredible training over there. What do you think the reason is that Americans are able to use LVAD therapy, which we're going to talk a lot more about later, but why are they using it on such a bigger scale than we are?
I think there's two things. I think one was at the time that LVAD therapy became available and became more around, the regulatory component and also the funding component in America was a little bit more open. And so they were able to get an approval for funding for this device to be a long-term therapy device, the device that someone has for forever. Whereas in Australia, it's really only indicated for people to get used to get them to transplant. And so because of that, it's a very different size of population. Transplant's a very niche area, only gets to go for a certain number of people to be able to get that. The other difference being that, and so that just meant that there was a lot there. The other thing is just to do with the funding nature of where it is, right? So because it's all private insurely funded, well, not all, but, you know, 2/3 of Americans are funded by private insurance, and even the last third by Medicare is a quasi-private insurance just done by the government.
Yeah, and operates sort of outsourced through private firms, right?
Yeah, and it's done in a very similar mindset, right, in terms of the way that they approach healthcare. It means that basically they just made a judgment call that anything, irrespective of the cost, if it meets certain criteria for mortality and for reduction in healthcare utilization, then they're happy to pay for it. These devices have like a very high sticker price, but have a very good long-term mortality and morbidity outcomes, which is not the way that we think about healthcare in Australia. So it is, we're changing, and that has changed over the last decade. And so that's really good. But that is why in America, and actually, to be honest, in a large part of Europe, in Germany, in Austria, in France, they have a much higher per capita utilization of LVAD therapy than in Australia because of the rationale for what gets funded of that high sticker price and high cost or upfront cost utilization for healthcare.
That's fascinating. What about the UK out of interest? I mean, obviously, a radically different system to the United States.
The UK is exactly like Australia. Okay. So the UK actually probably does less per capita LVADs than Australia does because they are even further away from America than we are. So, yeah, hence why I ended up going to America and not to London like everybody else for their training and fellowship.
Well, you just told me a little bit about your PhD, but if you wouldn't mind rehashing it for the audience, it sounds fascinating. You went to Philadelphia, right?
Yeah, so my PhD was... a large component was done in Philadelphia, and it was looking at the effect of LVAD therapy on the brain, and in particular, the effect of LVAD therapy on how the brain responds to changes in blood flow. So the good thing I did in Philadelphia was there's a bespoke device that exists there. It's only in a few places in the world, Philly being one of them. The inventor of it is now the chair of physics at the University of Pennsylvania.
He's not a doctor then?
No, he's a physicist, and when I was trying to explain to him what an LVAD was, the engineer in him arced up and suggested a whole bunch of things where I was like, yeah, that's actually a really good point.
I hope you wrote those down, yeah.
I actually did, but he basically has developed a device that would allow real-time, non-invasive measuring of blood flow in the brain. And they were using it a lot in the stroke population, but had yet to use it in an external population. And so what we did and what I did for my PhD was to look at it on patients who had an LVAD and who were then going to get their LVAD speed change, just to see what the effect of speed change had on the blood flow in the brain. And it's very fascinating. It's currently under embargo at a paper. So hopefully once the paper gets released, I can come back and talk in more detail about it or direct you in the editor of the journal.
Might have to do an update in future. Okay, that sounds good. And last question. So you're a Sixers fan, right? I think I did a little bit of research, found out you're a Sixers fan. Were you a Sixers fan before you moved to Philadelphia, or was that a product of being around people who are mad crazy about them?
So I was not a Sixers fan before I went. I was a basketball fan before I went, and so loved basketball of the generation of Luke Longley on the Bulls and watching the NBA when I should have been studying for exams and things like that. And so I'd always loved basketball. And then when I went to Philly, had the privilege that my wife let me spend an inordinate amount of money on season tickets to the Sixers.
Oh,
so
wow.
When I arrived, I got season tickets for the year, shared it with a friend of mine who was also Australian but living in Philadelphia, and went to a lot of games. And when you're there, it's hard not to get swept up.
You get
up,
wrapped up, don't you? Yeah. I had the same thing in Boston. I was suddenly a Celtics and a Pats fan out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, I will always hold that against you for the rest of the ride, because we hate Celtics fans, and everyone in the world hates Celtics fans. It also helped that the Sixers got good all of a sudden when I got there. They'd been terrible in the year that was the first playoff year. And so I then fell in love with them for the year, and now I am a long-suffering Sixers fan, unfortunately. So if you ever wander past my office in the middle of the day, often you'll see the basketball up on one of the two screens that I have running while I'm doing clinic notes.
That's fantastic. All right, well, we'll get stuck into the meat. And I thought, you know, today's podcast is going to be about mechanical circulatory support, really the durable mechanical circulatory support. But I thought we'd dial it back first and just talk about stage D advanced heart failure, i.e., the people who are getting these devices and who are eligible for these devices. And so could you give me a good definition of stage D or advanced heart failure? Do those two things mean the same thing, stage D heart failure, advanced heart failure?
They do, and I think it's a... So stage D is a very specific component of it, which basically just means that you are so symptomatic that it is affecting your everyday life and you're unable to do general activities of everyday life. And there's some really specific criteria that make you stage D, but we want to give it the catch call, and there's been a change in the field to stop calling it stage D and to call it advanced heart failure, to call it a little bit more broadly. And part of that was to take a little bit from our cancer colleagues to be able to understand that, you know, not all metastatic cancer is metastatic cancer, right? But just understanding that if there's metastases, that's bad, is what we're trying to do. So the idea of advanced heart failure, or calling it advanced heart failure, is just such that it's causing such a degree of imposition on your life that you're not that able to live the sort of life that you would want to live, right? So what are we...
Practical definition, or a very functional definition?
Yeah, so we want to make it more practical, make it more applicable. So the kind of things we talk about are needing to be hospitalized multiple times within a year, not being able to do normal daily tasks like have a shower or dress yourself, or not even being able to, you know, walk the distance to your bathroom, things like that. Obviously, there are more specific things in terms of like the size of your heart and how your heart function works, and then also like what your disease is and the kind of drugs that you're on and those sorts of things. But when I try to explain it to patients and to make it more broadly, it really is a kind of how sick you are in terms of how it's affecting your daily life. And that is actually where the key component comes, because the data shows that that is what drives you. So the sicker you are, the worse that you are. It doesn't really matter what the objective data shows
what
in terms
of your echo looks like, your MRI or anything like that.
Yeah. Absolutely. It really is about how it's impacting your life and therefore then what the relative benefit of then getting what is going to be high risk, high cost, high intensity therapy. So, you know, if you feel really well, your echo looks terrible, then it doesn't really matter what we do because you still feel really well. Yeah. If you feel terrible, then you're going to get a better bang for your buck in terms of therapy benefits.
And we should mention, I think, so all these patients have these symptoms despite essentially optimal therapy from the form of surgery or devices or medication. So they've kind of maxed out on all the initial stuff, right?
Absolutely. And the majority of these people, I would say, are well established into their course, right? So occasionally you'll get somebody rock into hospital, it's their first ever presentation and they're so sick that they're not able to get any further. That's A group. It's pretty rare nowadays. But the majority of these people are down the track, 6, 12, 24, even maybe 10 years down their heart failure journey. And now they've got to the point where, as you've said quite eloquently, they've had all the stuff done. They've gone through all the steps. And despite all of that, their heart has now failed. And it is failing to a point where it's not going to be able to cut it on its own.
And survival in these people, actually didn't realize this, but basically ranges from 6 to 25%, sounds like at 1 year, and 25% sounds like it's being generous. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. So that's the nice numbers that we say to people. The real number that I quote for patients, which is where it is, which is when we're at, is that if you look at the clinical studies that compare the different therapies, when you look at the placebo arms of any of these advanced heart therapy trials, it's usually between 30 and 50% one-year mortality. Median survival is around about 18 months in this population. So they're quite sick, really.
Very unwell. And so at this point, you really have sort of, as far as I can see, three options, you know, well, I guess full palliation / plus or minus inotropes to help support quality of life during that point in time, durable mechanical circulatory support, which we're going to talk about today, and then heart transplant. Is that roughly the sort of options you're presented with once you get here?
Absolutely. So you're left with one of three options. And I think it's really good that you mention palliative and supportive care and supportive inotropes, because I think that is an important thing that often gets forgotten and doesn't really get discussed as an option. Because we are talking about symptom benefit and symptom control. And some people are too sick to go through an operation, right? Too sick to get to the point they're there, or have some other comorbidity that means they're boxed out of this. And it's very easy to shake your head and say, there's nothing else we can offer you and kind of send on your way. But, you know, I had a lot of patients on palliative inotropic therapy in America that we were able to look after. I had a handful in Sydney as well. And they got a lot of benefit, right? It kept them out of hospital. It allowed them to get to the point where they were able to be at home, be somewhat independent, be able to see their family. And so I think that is really an important one to put in. But you're right. The bucket is moderately empty at this point in time. I will say that if we have the privilege to come back and do this maybe in 3 years' time, I hope to give you 10 different things of an option rather than now, because the future is bright. But as we stand today, there's really only three things for stage three heart failure.
Transplant or a durable device. And so if we think about the ratio, and this is some interesting statistics I was looking at, the ratio of people who receive an LVAD or transplant versus those who are actually candidates to get it, I was looking in the United States, which sounds like could probably be much better than here, is about 1 to 6. So every 6 people who could potentially get one of these devices only, or a transplant, only one of them do. Now, I can get why heart transplants are underutilized. I mean, we only have a limited number of organs and there's not many donors available. Why are LVADs so underutilized? And you touched a little bit about it in Australia before, but it sounds like even in America, this is a problem as well.
I think it's twofold. I think part of it is there is a lot of disparities in healthcare, even in America, but certainly disparities in terms of regionality of healthcare and where people can access care and where people are available. If you're fortunate enough to live somewhere that is close to a center that gets you to the things that you need, then you often will get the things that you need. And there's some really interesting data out there just looking at sort of postcode analysis of your postcode being a really strong risk factor to whether or not you actually get therapy that you need. I also think that there's a lot of late referrals, which is why I kind of made that point earlier on about the shift in the way that we think about it. We as a heart failure field spend a lot of time and a lot of energy and effort to try and convince people that the way that you make a diagnosis of advanced heart failure is with the following criteria. By the time people reach that following criteria and then they spend the 3 months waiting to get an appointment with somebody like me, all of a sudden you're too sick to get anything at that point in time. So I think part of it is just a bit of the recognition, and part of it is actually just getting people earlier in their disease process so they're strong enough, fit enough, well enough to be able to get it and get through an operation that might potentially be on the table for them.
So, you know, I'm a non-LVAD, non-advanced heart failure guy, just a regular cardiologist, regular Joe. Can you give me a case example of someone who might be typically missed by someone like me? Or, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, when I think about it, maybe someone who's had a couple of hospitalizations, and that is that enough to trigger, even if otherwise in between those hospitalizations they're doing sort of okay, just get them in early to an advanced heart failure specialist?
I think the hospitalization one, usually people, once they get to the point they get hospitalized, they're the ones that we can sometimes capture, and I think they're well captured. The one that is the classic, and the one that I always say, is the person that's been on heaps of meds for a while, right? So they've been stable on their four pillars of medical therapy, they're happily taking it, they feel really well. Then all of a sudden their blood pressure starts to dip and you notice that you've had to half their dose of their beta blocker, or you had to stop their ARNI because their kidney function went off, or, you know, they were on a dose of diuretic and now they've had to double it or triple it, right? They haven't been sick enough to get to the hospital, but they're just starting to slide, or they were able to work and now they're suddenly not able to work because they're a bit breathless. They're still fine. They've never been in a hospital. They've never needed IV diuretics. They've never needed any of these things. That's the group, right? And the group where you notice that they're not able to take the tablets they were before, that's probably the sweet spot okay. to catch someone. That's
a good thing to take home from there. All right. So, well, let's move on to actual mechanical circulatory support. So what you do now when you see them. Could you give me a nice definition of durable mechanical circulatory support, or mechanical circulatory support at large? MCS, to make this conversation easier.
Yeah, so MCS is great. And, you know, we split it up into kind of temporary and durable, but the concept is still the same, which is that your heart's to cactus to be able to get blood moving the way that it needs to. So we need to put something in you to help facilitate improving and getting more flow going around. So when we talk about durable MCS, it's about utilizing a device, usually that's surgically implanted, to be able to then augment or assist the flow that you get. So there are multiple devices that exist, but when we talk about durable MCS, the kind of workhorse device we talk about is a left ventricular assist device, and they're kind of intrapericardial devices at the moment.
Yeah, well, could you tell me a bit about artificial hearts and how they differ from a ventricular assist device?
Or yes. So the difference between an LVAD or left ventricular assist device and then a total artificial heart or TAH is literally whether your heart is still there. So the idea of an assist device is it is there to assist and augment the heart function working as it is, but your heart is still there. So it's still working. This is just acting separately. Think of it like if your basement is flooded and then you put in a sump pump, right? So there's still a drain. There's still a drain coming out of your basement. But if you put the sump pump in, it helps the flow and helps the water get out sooner, right? That's how it drains easier, right? A total artificial heart, you have to fit it in. You have to take their heart out. So there is nothing left. That machine is replicating the entire heart function. And why that's relevant is twofold. So one, a left ventricular assist device usually assists only one ventricle. So usually we just put it on the left. That's why we call it a left ventricular assist device. You can use a right ventricular assist device to go on the other side, but universally we put it on the left side only. So it's really only helping one side of the heart. Whereas the TAH will support your whole body, right? Your right and your left side, and gives you biventricular support. The other thing is that you are then mechanically dependent. So if it stops, if you accidentally disconnect yourself, if there is a mechanical problem, you will die. And people do die, and people did die. These are still machines, although they are good machines and they are excellent and have had to go through a lot of testing. If you're a simple person like I am and you think about, you have an option to either have a device where if it stops, you're dead, or have a device where if it stops, you still have your old heart.
Yeah.
It wasn't great. It was kept you alive before the bad word in, right? So it's still there and it's still kind of working. I know which one I would choose. Yeah. So TAHs were in vogue and were what everyone worked towards for the first, I would say, decade of bad therapy. And it worked out very quickly that making someone fully mechanically dependent was maybe not the best thing in their device. And so we've now shifted towards just looking for ventricular assist devices and then trying to create them in such a way that if you do need them for both sides, you either just put two in, like one on each side, or get people early enough that a single-sided support is going to be enough for them.
And the last one. So are we implanting any TAHs in Australia?
TAHs are on the shelf at both the Alfred and at St. Vincent's. It's been a long time, at least to my understanding, about it being them having an implant, which is there. I will say it's very exciting, and it's one of the things that I love about being an Australian in this field is that we really punch above our weight in terms of research and development. So there's a company that was initially based out of the group in Brisbane. Unfortunately, it's had to move to America to commercialize. Yeah, Bivacor from Professor Daniel Timms, who was running the program up at the in Queensland in terms of, it's called Q Medical Heart, and it was the group that was creating early devices, and they've developed a brand new total artificial heart device that is about to go into first-in-man clinical studies and will hopefully be implanted soon in Australia as well. So that's very exciting, and that's like going to be the next step in the future of biventricular devices and total artificial hearts. They're on the shelf here. They're used very infrequently. To be honest, they're used very infrequently even in America as well.
Because of what you're talking about, that mechanical dependence, is that the main problem that people... That's
the main one. And secondly, there's a degree of kind of operator knowledge as well as like implantation knowledge that's really specific. And when you stop doing things, it's very hard to remember how to do it. So it's a device where, you know, there are only a handful of centers in America that do it, one center, two centers in Australia that do it, just because you need someone who remembers how to do it. You need the staff to understand how to use the machine. It's not simple technology is what I will say. None of it is simple technology, but TAHs in particular are not simple technology, and there's very little margin for error. And so because of that, the decision of the field in general was to consolidate care into areas of really high level expertise, which is what we've done here. So it's on the shelf here if you ever need it. But as a general rule, most centers will use just two LVADs in a different configuration.
I was going to say, from a health economic and health strategy planning point of view, it seems like this whole field is sort of quite tricky. You do have to centralize your care, but as you said before, that means a lot of people miss out on care who don't live close to those big centers or don't live in a center that's connected to one of those centers. That's really tricky, but thanks. So it sounds like at the moment, VADs, ventricular assist devices, are where we're at. Okay, well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about indications for durable MCS. And so I'm aware that there's bridge to transplant, destination therapy, and then bridge to decision as well about transplant. Could you talk about how what each of those means, and then I guess in Australia what the play is and who's getting what? What are we doing here?
Yeah, these are historic terms that came from the FDA, and it's one thing that a lot of us in the field, myself included, are working hard to kind of move away from, and I think over the next decade we'll move away from this kind of nomenclature. But it is what it is, so it's important that people understand, because when you read about it, this is what it is. So basically, bridge to transplantation is exactly as described. So the idea is that the device is put in to keep you alive long enough to be able to survive to get a heart transplant in someone that otherwise would die waiting for a heart transplant. Bridge to candidacy is kind of a slight segue on that, where you have some kind of relative contraindication to transplantation that is time dependent. So the two classic ones that we discuss are smoking. So being an active smoker or smoking within 6 months is a contraindication to transplantation, but these devices can keep you alive for a reasonable period of time. So if you're so sick, you're not going to live your 6 months otherwise, whack a vat in, keep them alive till they clock out their 6 months and then be able to go forward. Similar for something like weight loss or diabetes control, things that you can fix on their own.
Okay, yeah.
So that's the bridge to candidacy component. Those two things come together, and both of those are what are currently funded in Australia by the government. There's an item number for it, and that's what the current utilization for. Destination therapy is the complete opposite, which is this is the device you're going to get to keep you alive, and this is all you get. So these are for people that are either not a candidate for transplant, don't want to get a transplant. Usually they're people that are too old to meet criteria for transplantation or have a contraindication, which means they're never going to be able to get there, such as a malignancy that you need to be 5 years cancer-free. It's unlikely anyone's going to live 5 years on LVAD. So this is kind of what we use the device for. And so that group of people is a very different kind of group of people elsewhere. The field is shifting to talk about it rather than that, to talk about it as short-term versus long-term device therapy. So this is, you're a short-term LVAD patient or you're a long-term LVAD patient, just so we don't consider, well, you actually are probably a DT patient, but maybe you could get a transplant at some point in time, like if you had cancer, and actually if you survive 5 years, maybe we should reconsider your candidacy. So we want to shift towards short-term, long-term, but that's, I guess, the three basic
destination therapy is very definitive, isn't it? It's kind of, yeah.
And it's very definitive for patients, right? It's all about a little bit about expectation management. And so if you tell a patient this is your destination, it's very hard that then in 5 years to be like, hey, by the way, maybe you could have a transplant. And they're like, what are you talking about? So
change the destination on the flight. Yeah,
absolutely. So calling it there is a little bit nicer. And it also is easier for people to understand why why there's then a culture shift in the way we utilize the devices.
So in Australia, are we doing much what I'm going to call destination therapy or short-term therapy? Is that, you said that it wasn't on the MBS for that?
So it is not currently approved in Australia for destination or long-term therapy. So the only people who can implant it are people who are either on the transplant waiting list or are transplant eligible. They're the only people who can get it. So hence why there's maybe not quite as high utilization. When you look at the American statistics of the utilization of VADs currently, over 80% of VADs implanted in America are long-term or destination indication. So it is such a small proportion of the overall kind of utilization in the world that you can then understand why it's such a small utilization in total in Australia of VAD therapy.
Okay, that makes sense. So I guess that's a lot of the sort of peripherals around VADs, and let's get into the actual VADs themselves. Are you able to give me a bit of a history of where VADs started? I mean, I know we had pulsatile flow, and was that, you know, are you trying to mimic, I guess, the pulsatile flow of the heart? Was that designed intentionally because we thought that was necessary? Is that why pulsatile flow was a big thing?
Yeah, so the evolution of LVAD therapy really similarly mimics the evolution of cardiopulmonary bypass therapy for people who are having an operation in cardiac surgery, right? So it started with literally as it is, the heart pumps, so we should use a pump. So it was a pneumatically driven pump. It was a device that was roughly the size of a dinner plate, and it was probably around about 10 to 12 centimeters thick, and it had inside it a pneumatic opening that just blew up and down, right? Yeah, it was very loud, and that's how it pumps, right? And it literally would push the blood forward. The idea being that, like, that's how we thought we would displace blood, right? It's pretty common sense. It kind of works.
The body came up with that. We should stick to it, yeah.
Yeah, terrible from an engineering component, right? Horrible for blood flow, high risk of clotting, high risk of just destroying blood cells because you're just squishing turbulent. Them against it. Bad turbulent flow, and also just very big, right? If you can imagine that something the size of a dinner plate and you're a lady that's 5 foot nothing, where's it going to fit, right? So these devices used to be put in the abdomen. They would hang below the chest. They'd be inside. There are even smaller versions for children that would sit outside the chest because that's how big they were. Not great. And obviously not great for quality of life, not great for stuff. So very much used just for short-term therapy. You know, the average life expectancy for that population was maybe like 12 to 18 months. But that's enough to get you a transplant most of the time. So that's where it was. The real kind of massive leap forward was this decision to move from pulsatile to continuous flow. This idea that actually when you get out to the periphery, you get to the kidneys, get to the brain, the eyes, the legs, blood's not pulsatile anyway, right? It's pretty much flat, right? If you put a probe in any of those organs, the blood flow is pretty flat anyway. So it probably doesn't need to actually be pulsatile coming out of the heart as long as you get enough blood to where it gets to. So the first device was basically built around the concept of a jet engine. It had a rotor inside that was like an impeller that turned. It was like an Archimedes screw. So basically sucked the blood out of the ventricle and then back up into the aorta. That device was called the HeartMate 2. It's an axial flow device, which means the blood flows in the direction of the spinning rotor. And it was pretty large. It sat, again, below the diaphragm and came up. Good device, workhorse device, was the one we used for a long time and really pushed the field forward. Biggest problem with that is just the way that the blood moved and blood turned created a lot of problems with clotting and thrombosis within the pump.
Inside the pump, right, okay.
And so that then evolved to what we have our current generation of LVADs, which are also continuous flow, but they are what we call centrifugal flow, which basically means the blood comes out at 90 degrees. So rather than using an Archimedes screw, it uses a little rotor, which is like a disc that has grooves built into it that is levitated by magnets, and then those magnets cause it to spin. The best way that I can think about it or describe it to patients, because it's a really complex but kind of cool thing to do, is if you ever watch any of those videos of how the like super fast trains work, they're levitated and then it spins and they're maglev, right? And so these are maglev devices, and the idea is that it spins, and it spins at such a frequency to turn that then causes the blood to come out at 90 degrees.
Okay. And so the landmark sort of trial, as far as I can tell, was Rematch, which was 2001, and that was an old school pulsatile device. But even there, I mean, the reduction or the increase in survival was pretty impressive. I think the people in the medical therapy arm had 25% at 1 year versus 52% there. And it sounds like basically proceeding towards centrifugal flow, we've just seen better and better numbers at 1 year. Is that about right?
Yeah, so we've gone from what you're describing in Rematch, which is a landmark study and one of these ones where you look at it and you think back to what it would have been like if you were around there. Luckily, I'm not quite that old, but to have been in a room when someone gets to say you take a group of people where they have like 25% one-year survival to 55%. That's huge, right? Yeah. That's more than a lot of the studies that we look at and we talk about as being like, you know, gold standard therapy now. There's been incremental benefit. So we've gone from 50% one-year survival with Rematch through the HeartMate 2 device, which was about 70% one-year survival, through the HeartWare LVAD, which was the next generation that came along, the first of the centrifugal flow devices. It was around about 80%, through to the current device we have now, which is the HeartMate 3, which is a fully magnetically levitated continuous flow device. The Momentum 3 study was the one for that. It had a 89% one-year survival. The reason why 89% is such a magical number for us is that the one-year survival post-transplantation, irrespective of what's happened over the last 30 years, has been completely stable at 90%.
Wow.
So we are at the point now where, and I firmly believe this, there is a group of people for whom an LVAD as therapy will give them the same short to medium term survival as a transplant. We've never been in that position before, but the fact that we are in that position now is pretty revolutionary, and it really makes me wonder what might happen in 5 to 10 years time, where we might even get past that even further.
I mean, that'd be incredible, wouldn't it? Yeah. What quality of life do you think that they might get that same short to medium term survival. Do you think their quality of life would be as good as someone who's had a transplant?
It's a great question, and it's really hard for me to say. I can only go by what patients tell me and where it is, especially the group of people that get an LVAD and then go and get a transplant. Yeah. So I'd be lying to you if I said that people with an LVAD had the same quality of life as people with a transplant.
Okay.
Because they don't, and that's pretty safe to say. So one of the things that I failed to mention with an LVAD is that obviously the device sits inside the heart and sits inside the chest and moves the blood around, but it's still a device. It is still an electronic device that needs battery power to function, and it needs some kind of information to make it work, just like any computer, any device that we use. That is all housed in a controller, and the controller and the battery sit outside the body. So these patients, obviously, while the device is inside, have a little tube that comes out, which is called a drive line, sits outside the chest and is then connected to batteries that then controls the pump and allows the pump to function. That is the thing that causes the biggest impact on their quality of life. Because if you imagine you were just a normal human being, especially someone in Australia, right? Go to the beach, go for a swim, just walk around with shirt off, just doing what like normal people do, right? Now, all of a sudden, you have a tube sticking out of you. You have to walk around with like a little device. It's not big. It's maybe the size of a VHS for old people, or I don't know, small, like a Game Boy or something like that, right? It's not big. You can still carry it in like a laptop bag or like a backpack, but you still have that. It means you can't swim, means you can't get access to water. So there is that quality of life impairment.
But despite that, it does look like, compared to medical therapy at least, I mean, much better quality of life than those people, right?
And that's what I always say to patients, is that you compare me to my alternative, don't compare me to the almighty, right? Yeah. That's the saying that people, that Joe Biden always says. And that's what it is, right? And so it's not comparing me to transplant, which is like the most amazing thing. If everyone could have a transplant, of course, that's what we would do.
Yeah.
It's comparing me to what the alternative was, which is frequent hospitalizations, basically being bedbound, MIHA, not having quality of life.
Breathlessness, yeah.
Absolutely. And when you compare to that, they're much better, right? I mean, that quality of life is significantly improved.
I was amazed. I think I read that almost all the patients, 77% of patients in Momentum 3 who were NYHA 4 before their implant went to NYHA 1 or 2. And I didn't think 1 would be on there. I mean, I don't know how generous they were with the grading of 1, but that's amazing, right?
There's a paper that was recently published that I'm glad someone finally did the analysis. I've wanted to for a long time and just never had any bandwidth or support, but I'm glad someone did, which was that it is about 40% of people who get an LVAD go back to work.
Wow.
This is not hospitalized. This is not needing to be on medical therapy. This is going back to doing a work-based activity for what they have. That is remarkable. That is almost as much as transplant. It's certainly more than a lot of people who get like advanced therapies for cancer or advanced therapies for lung disease or anything like that.
There's a lot of meaning in that, right? I mean, yep. In your perception of yourself as an individual being able to do that, it is a lot better than as a non-LVAD person, I kind of think of someone getting an LVAD and think of them being bedbound but alive, but that doesn't sound like the case at all. You just can't swim, yep. Really. So I do want to come back to what you were talking about, the anatomy of an LVAD. I like that. So, you know, just so people understand, you sort of have an inflow cannula which goes to a pump, which is a variable design but currently looks like a centrifugal maglev thing that takes the blood and pumps it back out into an outflow cannula into the aorta. And then from the pump, you have a line that's tunneled through into the abdomen and then out. Is that right?
Yep.
And then out and connects to a controller and a battery, which is the computer and the battery, essentially.
Yep.
Okay. So The battery, does it have to be charged?
Yeah. So, if you could ask any LVAD physician and any LVAD patient, what do they want improvement on? It is battery technology. It's like we have cars that can drive you for like 1,000 kilometers and then we're still using the same batteries as before. So the batteries do have to be charged. So usually you have two batteries because the idea is that everything needs a fail-safe. This is an FDA requirement for any of these sorts of things. So you have two batteries. Each individual battery will provide about 4 to 6 hours worth of battery life. So two batteries can often get people through the day. Having said that, inside the control itself is an emergency backup battery that has about 30 minutes to an hour worth of power in case something happens to the two other batteries, you're like caught out somewhere, you don't have them. We also tell patients to always take two batteries with them, so they're carrying around batteries. The biggest thing, these batteries weigh about 750 grams to a kilogram.
So if they carry it, they've got two in there and then they've got another two in there. Handbag, they're always kind of walking around with almost 4 kilograms.
Yep, so 4 to 5 kilograms that they have with them at any given time. So it is hard, especially hard for some of our older patients to be able to manage that. It's like it's not easy, it's very heavy. So they are always connected. But gone are the days when I first started, battery life was about 2 hours. So to get to battery life now being like 6 to 8 hours is pretty amazing, especially for those people who want to work, right?
Yeah.
Or people who are out and about during the day. It really has allowed them to be much more independent than they were before.
And so charging, is it the same as I charge my smartphone? I get home, put it on the dock at the start of the night, stare at it too much overnight? Or is it...
Well, staring at it is just your problem. You need to make it flow black and white like I do. No, so the batteries go into a little hub. So they sit individually into a little hub. They... little brackets that then they sit and they charge them. And so every patient goes home with 6 batteries. So 4 can charge at any given time and 2 that are on. For sleeping overnight, they get connected. One remains connected to a battery as their fail-safe, but they connect the other directly to wall power. So you can connect it to a wall power adapter that then allows you to be connected to wall power overnight. So then it's not going to run out overnight. So you can sleep for longer periods of time.
Okay.
They used to make one for the car. They used to make a car adapter that has gone a little bit by the wayside, but they had a adapter for the car for people to be able to plug in when they were in the car. I know some patients who still do that. I'm not sure they're allowed to, but there are ways that you can work around it. And I had a patient of mine in Washington, D.C., who we arranged to fly to his home in Ethiopia, which he hadn't visited for a long period of time. It took a lot of work on the work of our support team, but he flew, and what he managed to do was connect himself up to wall power in the seat in the airplane. Wow. So was able to be connected up. So that's how he was able to be on the flight for the eight hours.
Watch that plug. Don't knock it out when you fall asleep.
But also just like on there was pretty amazing. And it was really great for him to be able to do that and to be able to have some degree of independence. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah. He must have been very thankful or very grateful for you guys. Well, I just want to talk about the types of LVAD as well, because this is something that always confused me. And I think I understand it now, but you know, I think for all intents and purposes, it sounds like there's only one that's being implanted now. And I'll dial back, actually. So there are two companies that were making LVADs, Medtronic and Abbott, is that right?
Yeah.
And that Medtronic is no longer making theirs, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So they had the HeartWeb HVAD, which I think stopped selling in 2021.
Yep.
What was the reason for that?
So there was a couple of different reasons. I think, firstly, as with any iteration of device, when you start to get technological advancement and something goes past you, companies have to make a decision whether they want to then use R&D to then try and move to the next one. They had an R&D device that did not eventuate, and so this is an old generation device. So they essentially, for want of a better term, sunsetted the device. It was never designed to like last for forever. Their just next iteration never came through, in the same way that the Abbott device, which is the HeartMate 3, replaced the HeartMate 2. So they were able to kind of then create and then move forward in terms of generational. I think it was twofold. One, as every device evolves, they've got hopefully lower complication rates. The HeartWare HVAD device had a reasonably high rate of stroke, higher than the Abbott HeartMate 3 device. And because of that, they reached a point where there was no longer equipoise between the devices. It was pretty clear that the stroke rate was unacceptably higher in one device versus the other. So it's hard to make that justification. So appropriately, the company said, well, we can't fix this. This is an unfixable problem.
It's just part of the device, the way it's currently engineered.
Yep. And so therefore, we don't feel like we should continue to allow people to implant a device where we even think it's probably not as good. Pretty ethical. The other issue was that there were some issues in terms of some mechanical issues with the pump. It was not so much that it was like a very widespread mechanical problem, but it was such that they couldn't actually isolate why it was having the mechanical problem. So it was very rare. It was less than 0.01% of the total population. But as with anything that's a mechanical device that someone is dependent on for their life, if you can't work out what the problem is, it's not great. And so they, again, made the very ethical decision to say, look, there's a very small number of people, but we actually don't know why. And while we don't know why, we can't
predict who is going to happen to, and we can't help stop it.
Absolutely. And we can't ethically allow you to put a device in where, even though it's a very infinitesimal chance, that chance will have a very, very serious consequence. So between those two things together made the device that it was not in their interest to continue. And so they've ended pulling from the market, which has been disappointing. But although, as you've said, there are two mainstay devices now, there are, at last, my last count, 9 in development devices that have completed animal testing or enduring animal testing that are working towards first in man. So when I said to you before, come back to me in a decade, I'm going to have a heap more things to talk about. That's what some of this stuff is looking at. Stuff's very cool. Lots of companies all around the world are really working towards R&D in this area.
And so given it was only 2021 when Medtronic pulled the HeartWare device, we're still going to encounter people who walk around with one of these?
Absolutely. So there's still a large proportion. So I think in the States there's probably about 800 to 1,000 people walking around with a HeartWare LVAD. There's still a handful in Australia. The HeartWare LVAD was the device of choice here before it transitioned to the HeartMate 3. So I think there may be still a handful of people in Australia on that device as we stand currently. So it's still around and you still see it. It's a really good pump, actually. It was really moved the field forward. It's a pity, but it's what happens. Things get better. Newer is better and better is progress. So that's what we do.
Okay. And so what we're going to see now is probably mainly HeartMate 3s implanted. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So is that no one's putting in HeartMate 2s at all? There's no indication or use for them?
Not anymore. So they still make the pump for a replacement because obviously you still have some parts of the old device. So if you need to replace the pump for a mechanical problem or something like that, then having it around is helpful. But there is no one who's getting a de novo implant, certainly in Australia, but really anywhere in the world, who's getting a de novo implant with a HeartMate 2 at the moment.
Okay, all right. So that's actually, that helps clear it up because you see all these different devices and different designs and different company names. And I think sometimes they're even referred to like the HVAD and things. And it gets very confusing. So basically HeartMate 3 is what we're going to be seeing now in state of the art, but there's still a few HeartWares around and HeartMate 2s around in the population.
Yep.
All right. Now, I don't want to hold you down to this too much because obviously you're not a surgeon, but implantation-wise, what should we tell a patient? How do we actually put these in?
So there's two different ways that you can approach, but the concept is still the same, which is the operation itself is not an overly complicated approach. Again, I'm not a surgeon, so I always say this with my tongue firmly in my cheek, is that it's really not that complicated, so why is it so hard? But it really is, especially in terms of what our cardiothoracic surgeons do, which is some pretty amazing sorts of things. This is actually a bit more of a kind of easier bread and butter type of operation. So what they actually do is they cut a small hole in the apex of the left ventricle, which is where the LVAD sits in. They put a little ring on the heart itself, it's called a sewing ring, that basically has a lock attached to it. So they sew that on, they cut a hole out through the inside of the ventricle, they stick the pump in, and then it clicks into place and it holds into place on the sewing ring. They then attach the outflow graft, which is essentially just a Gore-Tex tube. It's about a centimeter and a half in diameter. They then attach that onto the aorta and then they turn the pump on and they're off to go. So that's about it. It
does sound relatively simple compared to some of the very impressive things those eyes can do.
So. Exactly. I always say that, you know, compared to a redo aortic valve, aortic root re-implantation of every vessel under the sun, it's actually a very easy operation. Yeah, it's even easier than like a complicated mitral valve. So it's like a big structure to do. So there's two different ways that you can do it. The most common approach is just with a standard sternotomy. So cut down the middle of the breast, open up, access the heart, go into the apex.
And you're on bypass for that?
You're on bypass and that's the classical way to do it. You can do it on, usually patients go into bypass mostly because they're quite sick before going in. So to allow some degree of support because they're obviously sick enough to need a VAD. So they're often quite unwell going in. There are some off pump VADs that have gone in, which is very impressive to see. My surgeon did a few of them in where I was in DC before we went, but it was pretty rare. But what he did do a lot of is what's called a lateral thoracotomy VAD. So the idea being, look, you don't need to access the whole heart, right? You just need to access the apex. So what he would do is he would cut under on the left-hand side of the chest, just underneath the nipple, usually off to the side in between the ribs, open up a space and then access the apex that way, and then only need to do a very small sternotomy, usually only one or two rib spaces at the top of the chest, to access the aorta, and then he would tunnel it up and be able to connect it up that way. So it saved the full sternotomy. It was a minimally invasive operation in the same way that you would do a minimally invasive bypass or a minimally invasive mitral valve replacement. The recovery time was much faster. People got out of the operating room a lot quicker. They got out of the... They had a shorter bypass time. They ended up getting out of the ICU quicker. They were able to get up and move around faster. And because they didn't have a full sternotomy, they didn't have sternal precautions. So sternal precautions for 12 weeks often can put a limitation or a bit of a barrier on rehabilitation after the operation. And given these patients are quite sick going in, you want to try and get them up and moving as fast as possible. So if they don't have sternal precautions, they're able to get to cardiac rehab a lot faster. They're able to get out and have a better recovery. So that's the alternate implantation technique that you'll see people read about. It's called a lateral thoracotomy approach.
Do you know if we're doing much of that in Australia?
Currently in Australia, the majority of people are just doing it through a standard sternotomy approach.
Okay. Yeah. All right, that's really helpful to know, to give people advice. And I read a lot about fixing valvulopathy while you're in there. And if you could comment just on that, I think maybe aortic regurgitation is one of the big ones, but obviously looking at the tricuspid valve as well and the mitral valve and whether or not something needs to be done on that front.
Yeah, the main valve that we look at is the aortic valve to get help with, and especially with aortic regurgitation. The concept just being that, look, if you are sucking blood out of the ventricle and you're sticking it out into the aorta, that aortic valve being competent and being able to stop blood going back in the ventricle is pretty helpful.
Unless you just have a closed loop, right?
Absolutely, and then you end up just not actually achieving what you wanted to in the first place. So the aortic valve is almost non-negotiable. There's a couple of different ways you can fix it. You can get a full valve replacement. What often people do, it sounds incredibly barbaric but actually works, is they just stitch the aortic valve together to make it more competent. So they do what's called a park stitch, which is where they just stitch the tips of the valves together. So it just holds it in place in the middle, still allows blood to go around the outside. Okay. On the very off chance that the pump fails, you can still get blood moving forward, not as much as you would otherwise, but it's there. Mitral valves, most people just leave by the wayside because they don't really need a lot and less is more. There has been a little bit of a push towards fixing the tricuspid valve a little bit, just because obviously we're only supporting the left-hand side of the heart. We're not supporting the right-hand side of the heart. And the evidence is very complicated as to whether it's beneficial or not. There's a lot of selection bias, because if you're good enough to get everything done in one go, you're probably going to end up getting a good outcome from it. Right. I'm very much a believer, as was my surgeon, that less is more. Get in, get out, get it done, and then you can always think about things otherwise. And I do think that now that there are
transcatheter options,
percutaneous options to fix, especially on the tricuspid side, that's what we were looking towards. And I think there'll be an era where people will just get their VAD put in and then get a TAVI for their aortic regurgitation or their aortic valve disease, and then go get a TriClip for the tricuspid valve disease, and they still get the one operation. So we'll see. We're not there yet.
Especially if you could do it by this lateral thoracotomy approach. It's really, that would be a revolution, wouldn't it? And so once they're out of theatre, they got to get on antithrombotic therapy because of the metal and, I guess, the alterations in flow. And so my understanding is that warfarin, such as Coumadin, and aspirin is your go-to now. Are we using standard INR targets? Is there any change or shift on that?
Yeah, so this is an area which I'm very excited to say there's been a big shift. So for the longest time, people got aspirin and warfarin. It came from the historic era of rematch and the very old pulsatile devices that clotted off a lot of problems. They put it on there. Very little data and evidence for any of this. So young Turks, like myself, used to always complain that there was no evidence or data. And a group in the States led by Nir Uriel, who is only a few, is maybe a little bit older than I am, but and Mandeep Mehra kind of got together and said, look, we do need to try and work out whether aspirin is relevant. So actually just completed a randomized control trial of aspirin versus placebo in LVAD therapy, which we were very proud to be a part of at my center. And also both centers in Australia were part of that study as well. And actually showed that you don't need aspirin. Aspirin actually is unnecessary. It just increases bleeding complications with no actual change in thrombotic complications. So aspirin's done.
Poor aspirin has really seen its heyday come to an end, hasn't it? Primary prevention, this, use with the DOAC after PCI. It's
I spent my life walking around being like, we should put the aspirin in the water. And now I'm like, well, I'm glad we didn't put the aspirin in the water because we don't need it for anything.
And so Coumadin is enough, really.
Coumadin is what we use at the moment. And it's just a standard indication of 2 to 3. Having said that, that is also changing as well. So part of what I did for my PhD is we did some early mocklip studies. So we created an ex vivo compatibility loop and looked at different DOACs, direct oral anticoagulant therapy, to see if any of them were safe. And it appears that the factor 10 inhibitors are safe. So using apixaban is the drug of choice is what we're using. And we have thankfully been able to now then start three randomized control trials looking at the safety of apixaban in LVAD therapy. So there's one that's being run out of St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, which is a little plug, but also one from the States and one from Europe. And between the three of them, they should hopefully be able to report and collate their data later next year. And then all together, we'll be able to have all of our information to hopefully be able to shift patients off warfarin onto a DOAC, just like everybody else in the world is no longer on warfarin.
The scene is really changing. If we think about our previous, minimally invasive approach and then the ability to be on just a DOAC, I mean, really, it becomes a lot more appealing, doesn't it?
It really is moving towards, we now know the devices work and they keep people alive. So what's the point of keeping people alive if it's really hard for them to recover from their operation and then they have to be on warfarin for forever? So now it's moved towards, how do we make the devices keep people alive for as long as we can, to how do we allow the quality of life and the life that the people live on these devices to be as nice and easy as possible.
Okay. So now back to the controller you were telling me about. Now, I understand that has three sort of main parameters that you look at. And there's only one of them that you can adjust, which is the speed of rotation, which sits at about 5 to 6,000 RPM, which is remarkably fast in the HeartMate 3. What are the other parameters? And then, I doubt that any non-VAD cardiologist is going to be playing around with any of these, but what sort of things are you looking at or how are you thinking about these three parameters?
So, as you said, the speed is the only thing that we can adjust. It's the thing that we do adjust. The other thing that is the only piece of information that is a direct number that is relevant is the power, which is the power consumption required to maintain that speed. Why that's relevant is it should be pretty fixed, right? The device should function pretty normally. It should work well. Just like when you're driving your car, if you drive your car and you're going at a certain speed, you know what the revs need to be at that speed to keep you at that speed. It's pretty stable. If you notice it looks different, right? If you notice that you have to put your foot down a little bit harder to maintain the same speed to get the revs going the same way, there's probably a problem.
Something's changed. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what we do. So the power is the number that we always look at. So the amount of power that is needed to maintain it spinning is stable. And then if there's a problem, like there's a clot or there's a problem with the pump itself, the power consumption is going to change, and that's what we monitor for. Having said that, we're cardiologists. We're smart, but we're really not that smart. So to make it smarter for us, because we hate looking at small changes in power, they created Flow. And Flow is just an algorithm. And what the algorithm for the Flow is it uses the resistance, which should be pretty fixed, right? The power, which is the amount of consumption to speed, the speed, which is what it's turning at, and then the size of the housing, which is also fixed, to be able to derive you a flow for the amount of flow that comes through. So it's not a real number, it's just a derived number. But the reason why it's presented to us is because it's easier to see a difference in the flow and be like, oh, the flow went from like 4 to 5 liters or from 5 to 2 liters. That's a problem. Then it's to say, oh, the power went from 3 watts to 3.2 watts because very subtle changes to see the difference. So the flow is a derived number. They're the two other numbers we look at. And we teach patients to look at the flow just in the same sort of way that your flow is going to be at a bit of a number. And then if you see it change or you see it alter as it goes along, then that probably is a marker that something else is going different.
Okay.
But it's not the real flow. So
yeah, it's really just you could calculate everything just using power and speed.
Yeah, right? And which is what actually most of us do. So most of us don't really look at the actual flow number, but it's just a number that's there to make
it
easier to
conceptualize. Gotcha. And so, I wanted to talk about alarms in LVADs, but I know there's a lot of alarms and I think they're prioritized into high risk and low risk alarms, which makes sense. If you're a non-LVAD physician or cardiologist, how should you think about alarms? What are the ones to worry about? What should you tell patients?
So it's really nice that as it's iterated, they've got better in terms of the way that the alarms work. So I say that it's exactly the same as when you walk into a CCU or an ICU, right? There's a lot of beeping. The thing beeps a lot. It beeps all the time and it's continually beeping, or it beeps really loudly, then that's a problem.
Okay.
For the alarms that are a problem, you will know it because you can hear it. It's a very loud alarm. The other thing that's very helpful is that there's a big red light on the front of the device.
Good.
So if there's an alarm and the red light is on, that's bad. If there's an alarm and there's no red light, it's usually less bad, and that's where it is. But okay, one of the things with the alarms and one of the things that we teach patients is you treat the patient, not the pump. At the end of the day, it's still the patient, right? So if your patient is conscious and is awake and it feels fine and there's an alarm going off, then you have time. You can kind of work things out. If they're unconscious, there's an alarm going off, then that's a big problem because they shouldn't be unconscious, right? People should be conscious. The other thing is that we, you know, we should always listen to patients, right? Patients should always be their own advocate and do stuff. And we're pretty bad as doctors. Often we don't listen to patients appropriately. This is one time specifically where that person in front of you will know infinitely more than you do about what is going on.
Yeah.
So if they say, don't worry about it, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
If they're like, wow, I haven't heard that before, that's the time to like freak out. And often if an LVAD patient presents to a random emergency department with someone who's never seen it, I will literally say, put me on speaker with the patient and you can tell them what is the alarm, right? Or tell them to read out what's on the screen, and then that's how we can help detect it a little bit. So don't feel like you're a lesser person if you have to ask the patient whether this is a problem or not. That's actually what we train patients to do and
better
expectation.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense because it seems like there are a lot of alarms, and if you're not familiar with the anatomy and the function of a VAD, you're going to be scratching your head. So I think that is interesting. And then, you know, one of the things that I'd read about is you can't really measure blood pressure traditionally as you would in a patient who doesn't have an LVAD because especially with non-pulsatile flow, they now have just sort of one blood pressure and you don't get your classic sound. So you need to use a Doppler machine.
Yep.
So I'm guessing a lot of people just don't have one of these hanging around. Is there any alternative, or, you know, do you just go back on your traditional clinical assessment of perfusion? Are they awake? Are they breathing? That sort of thing.
So yes to clinical assessment of perfusion. The thing that I always tell people is that, yes, we think that a lot of people don't have a Doppler ultrasound around. It's exactly the same machine and the same probe that you use to check for a baby's heartbeat. And it's remarkable how many of those are around.
Okay.
So every emergency department will have one of those, right? We don't think about it in that way because it looks very different and it's not the same physical machine, but it's the same principle and the same concept, and it's still listening for the same spot. So
brachial artery over there?
So normally you can do brachial. I actually usually will do radial because it's a little bit easier to kind of get access to it at that point. Just sitting over it to find it till you hear the sound, you'll hear a just general whooshing sound, and then inflate the cuff until you don't hear it anymore. So it's sort of that same kind of concept of a normal blood pressure. So yes, you need a Doppler to be able to do it. It's harder to access them. The other thing that I say to people, which is the other trick, which is there, is that you can use a finger, like an oxygen reader, like a Pleth, put that on. Obviously, it's getting blood flow, right? It may not be pulsatile, but it's not pulsatile in the finger bit anywhere. It's a little bit pulsatile, but not really. So it will record some degree of oxygenation.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, you put an oxygen probe on an LVAD patient, you'll be able to see how much oxygen they have because it'll work still. If you inflate that, right, it's going to stop recording, which is what happens with a normal human being. You inflate it, the finger Pleth stops working, it starts beeping, right? So we know that happens in real life. It still happens in VAD patients. So you can use that as your other dirty trick. It doesn't tell you an accurate number, but it can tell you whether it's like
critically
60
low
to 70 or like 30, right? Like, yeah, it can give you an idea of where you are in the grand scheme of where things
and
are.
And this number is essentially the map, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it's considered to be the map. Whether it's actually the map is a very complex discussion,
okay,
but it's considered to be the map, and we treat it and we document it as the Doppler map.
And we use the same parameters as we would for a map. So you're targeting 65, 70, somewhere around?
So we're a little bit more narrow than the standard map we would target, in the sense that at a lower bounds, absolutely. So 60, 65 is reasonable. Upper bounds are a problem. So we're not happy with people having maps 80, 90, 100, even though you might tolerate that in just a normal human being, because it's been shown that the higher your blood pressure is, the higher your map is in a VAD patient, the more likely you are to have a stroke. So it's definitely maps less than 90, really maps less than 85. If you can get it, maps less than 80. So 60 to 80, 65 to 75, if you can really want to be super narrow about it. But like 60 to 80 is kind of the range, which is lower than you would think in a general population.
Yeah. And is it hard to, I mean, I guess you have full control over the speed, as we said before. Is it hard to hit that number, or?
It isn't. So it takes some fiddling often. And with some patients, you need to bring them in to fiddle with their meds, but they do still respond to normal blood pressure therapy, right? So they still respond to beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and all the normal therapy because they still have blood vessels and those still exist. So even though the speed is what it is, you do need to give them the other therapy to allow the blood pressure to get controlled.
Okay, cool. Well, I think it's a good time to move on to the complications then. You kind of led into there and there seem to be a lot of them. I guess that's where the technology's at right now. But in no particular order, I want to talk about bleeding first. It seems fairly common. I was reading that 1 in 3 people are going to experience a bleed by 1 year. And it's not what I thought it was. It's due to actual changes that are as a result of the blood flow from VAD. So angiodysplasias and things like that. Could you talk more on that?
Yeah, so most of the bleeding is gastrointestinal. So you would have thought it's bleeding from where the pump went in, all those sorts of things. It's actually not. It's actually in the GI tract. It's a very similar sort of physiology to what happens with patients with severe aortic stenosis. So what happens is when you lose that pulsatility, you end up losing, especially in the GI bed, you end up losing that discrimination across between the arteriolar and venous pressures. So they end up basically getting AV malformations formed. So you end up getting basically kind of a mesh network between the arterioles and the venules, and especially in the GI tract where blood is still pulsatile, funnily enough. As opposed to the rest of the body, it's non-pulsatile. In the GI tract, blood is still pulsatile even into the stomach.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So that's where they end up having them. That is then combined with, A, they're on all of the blood thinners known to man, and B, which is why we're trying to get rid of the aspirin, and then B, what happens is as the blood goes through the LVAD, there are obviously shear forces as it's getting pushed past that spinning rotor. And what that does is that ends up cleaving von Willebrand factor, causes von Willebrand activation, and it basically makes you essentially von Willebrand deficient. So you combine three different factors. You've got these AV malformations that form. You make them functionally like a patient with von Willebrand deficiency who ends up being kind of thrombophilic. And you, on top of that, add on the fact that they're on full dose anticoagulation with aspirin. It's very common for them to get a GI bleed. So GI bleeding is very, very common. It's really probably the biggest complication that we see.
Yeah, and I guess you're really trying to avoid transfusing these patients because you don't want to sensitize them to everything if they're transplant bound.
So if they're transplant bound, absolutely. But if they're not transplant bound, then it doesn't really matter, right? And true. So this is this concept of the long-term versus short-term and what your goal is.
Yep.
Fill them up, just book them in for a blood transfusion every month or 2 months or 3 months if you need to. You know, there are ways that you can mitigate them waiting to the point where they're sick before they have something go on.
Yeah, okay. So that's bleeding, and then infection seems kind of obvious. I guess you've got a tube leading from your heart to the outside world. And again, 1 in 3 experience an infection within 1 year. It sounds like the majority of them are around where this drive line leaves the abdomen to go connect to your battery. Yeah. Is there anything we can do to minimize that risk?
So not really. So there's a lot of work being done to look at what we can to fix that. And unfortunately, it just is what it is. I think at this point in time, they've tried different drive line therapy. They've tried different materials, those sorts of things. Actually, Professor Dave McGiffin, when he was at the Alfred, was a real leader in this to try and create essentially kind of bio meshes to be able to help it heal better, to remove antibiotic meshes, things like that, to be able to work out what's happening in terms of the bioforma there. The answer is we just need to get rid of the drive line, basically.
Yeah,
so the future is fully implantable LVADs. They are one of the many devices that I've told you that are in the pipeline. But the idea is that now we have good battery technology. We've got wireless battery technology. I mean, I don't plug my phone in anymore. I sit it on my countertop and it charges through what's sitting on my bench. So we have the technology to do that. Applying that for battery charging technology would then mean we could internalize everything with the VAD. And if there's now nothing outside, there's nothing outside.
That would be a real game changer, right?
So the first fully implanted LVAD was implanted in Israel in 2021. They've since done a couple since then. It's using a very old technology pump called the Jarvik 2000. It's a really not a great pump.
Sounds like something out of an old school sci-fi, doesn't it? Jarvik 2000.
It is out of an old school sci-fi. As I said, implanted in Israel in 2021 and successful and was able to continue for that. So that was the first kind of proof of concept that we can charge it externally and have an external way to be able to charge the batteries. It's where the battery technology is the next spot to go. But I think that will be the next iteration of the device, is finding a way to make it fully implantable to remove at least one of these you know, the mainstay complications that we know about.
In the current world, when they do have the driveline, are they changing this dressing at home by themselves? They have to do all this?
Yeah, so we teach them how to change the dressing. Usually they'll change it anywhere between once a day to three times a week. Obviously, the less times it's changed, the less likely it's going to get infected, right? So it's a little bit of a balance of how you do it and how we do it. We teach the patients to do it themselves because actually if you teach one person how to do it properly, then they're going to do it properly. If you have a random nurse that comes out who then goes on holidays and it's a different person, that's when they are most likely to get infected. So,
but as you say, it just adds to the burden for these people again to have to do all those changes. Okay. Yep. And then pump thrombosis, and you kind of alluded to this before with the HeartWare device from Medtronic having sort of more pump thrombosis. It was pretty impressive in the Momentum 3. It looks like it's come down to 1.4% at 2 years compared to 14%. That's a tenfold difference with the HeartMate 2 versus the HeartMate 3. But I guess we're still having that. So signs of pump thrombosis would be flow dropping off, power dropping off?
Yeah, so usually the signs are that the power starts to go up because it needs more power to make it turn because you get clot forming on the rotor. The rotor's heavier, so it needs more energy to make it keep turning, right? The car's going up a hill, so you need to give more juice to maintain the same sort of speed. The other thing that you'll find is that then relevant to that, the flow will change as well because obviously not as much blood is flowing there. What we found is it's less about clot forming on the actual device spinning, which is what it used to do, which is what we would see with the HeartMate 2 and the HVAD devices on the actual rotor that spun is where the blood clot would form. Now, rather than forming there, it's actually forming above the actual device itself. So it's blocking the flow into the device. Right. And so you actually get this counterintuitive thing where the power actually stays the same because it's still spinning, but the flows drop precipitously because there's just no blood going in. So there's no blood moving around. So it's like spinning quite quickly. So patients become quite symptomatic because they're just not getting any blood flow coming through. And you can notice it from that point. That's, you know, often well seen by echocardiography or something like that. You can see where the blood clot is because it's outside. It's usually like either sitting like a pancake on top of the inflow cannula, or it's like sucked in and just sitting in the inflow cannula itself, just like a big blob that's
kind of terrifying
there.
Isn't it?
Just a little bit
blocking off that. And what do you do if so, because they're presumably already on warfarin.
So you can try to do medical therapy with some low dose thrombolysis. Sometimes works. I personally have had a bit of success and we've done it a little bit. It's there, but mechanical problems need mechanical solutions, right? So the answer is with a pump exchange. So usually they'll have to go to an operation, have the old pump removed and a new pump put in, which is not a small undertaking is what I will tell you. So the mortality from pump exchanges are not as high as the mortality from an upfront operation, but they are still high. And so we try to avoid it where possible.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that is obviously a critical complication, but it's good to see that it's come down so much. And then I guess moving into your wheelhouse is neurological events. And I didn't realize just how common these were in people who have HFADs and both bleeding and ischemic strokes at the same time, which creates a real clinical conundrum. What's the lay of the land here? You talked about hypertension and control of that.
It's bad is the answer. And it's why I think we're spending a lot of time looking at how to fix it, because nowadays strokes are the highest cause of both mortality and morbidity in LVAD patients, and causes the most disability and causes it's the most feared complication. The feared complication used to be pump thrombosis or mechanical failure. The feared complication now is stroke and neurological defects for the patients, because the unfortunate thing is while it does cause mortality in some patients that have a stroke, it's not in everybody. And then if you're then left to have a patient who is alive but
can't manage an LVAD,
absolutely,
disaster.
It makes it quite hard for them. So a lot of work is being worked to try and work out why. Is it at the level of the brain? Is it at the level of the pump? Is it the way we're doing it? Is it the way we're managing it? Can we fix it? So trying to find risk factors that put people at high risk and then mitigate that, blood pressure being a really good one that has now become just standard of care in all devices to keep a lower blood pressure. Or is it to do with the therapy we're using? Should we try different medicine? So there's a lot of kind of research taking a big step back to be like, okay, well, who's having strokes? Why are they having strokes? When are they having strokes? What can we find? One thing we have found is that a lot of patients who have strokes also have infections. So that's a really strong risk factor, is having an infection. And maybe it's this concept of, well, if you're actively infected, maybe you're a bit more prothrombotic, so we need to worry about it. So mitigating the driveline infections may then end up mitigating the strokes too.
Downstream effect, yeah.
Of how we can manage it. So where we get to is hard. I think it's probably the biggest problem. Like, you can manage bleeding, can generally manage infections, can generally manage most complications, can manage the heart failure. But the strokes are really hard to manage, and they probably really put a cap on the expansive use of this therapy and how we can then safely expand it to a much broader population.
Yeah, okay. Is the feeling that a lot of them probably are coming from the pump, or we just don't know?
We don't know, because you could say a lot of them are coming from the pump, but then pump thrombosis went from 30% to 1%, and the stroke rate is exactly the same. Yeah. So it's hard to say it's coming from the pump. It almost certainly has to do with the pump person interplay and where clot is forming, and we just aren't really sure about what is happening from that perspective.
Watch this space, I guess. Yeah. And right heart failure, which seems to be a big problem for a lot of people who stay on it for a long time. I mean, I guess I was seeing that it can happen acutely, obviously, like any other surgery. Coming off bypass can be difficult, but late stage people can develop right heart failure. Why does that happen, and what can we do about it?
Well, it probably happens from a couple of different things. The main one being, often for patients who are getting a VAD, the process that has affected the left-hand side of the heart has also affected the right-hand side of the heart. So we'd be pretty naive to think we fix one half and just the other half's going to magically going to get better, right? So this, it's what I always laugh. I read all these papers that get sent for review or sent for comment, and they all come up with the same thing, which is the strongest predictor of late right heart failure is early right heart failure. And the strongest predictor of early right heart failure is that your right heart was bad before your VAD went in, right? So that, I think, is the biggest thing, is that we are taking a really sick group of population. We're only fixing one side. So hence why there's been some thought and discussion about how we support both sides of the heart simultaneously. But I also think that there's a lot to do with two different things that we did really badly before, but we do a lot better now. So number one is, we would put the VADs in the person, and we would send them on our way, and we would just treat them like we'd fix them, right? So we didn't give them any guideline-directed medical therapy for heart failure. We stopped all of that at the operation. We just never restarted it, because we never did, right? We just didn't. And then we were surprised that they ended up having heart failure. Yeah. And then now we are surprised, well, not surprised, but it has been shown that if you give people standard, good old-fashioned guideline-directed medical therapy, even though they have a VAD and even though they have normal blood flow and normal perfusion, they still get benefit in terms of reducing right heart failure. So we put them on normal GDMT, and that generally helps. The other thing that we've realized is there's probably an anatomical effect of the septum. So when you put a VAD in, you take someone's heart, which has spent a long time getting used to pressures and volume and things happening in the left ventricle, and then the right ventricle has worked to cope. You put the VAD in, it's sucking blood directly out of the left ventricle, and that then pulls the septum across, which then means the right ventricle gets bigger and it's not contracting as well as it should. So understanding that septal interplay, and then how we then optimize and change the speed of the VAD, the position of the LVAD, where it points in the heart itself, kind of how we run it, what all the other meds we use, how we optimize the person and the heart as a whole, rather than just more is more, which is what we'd historically done with the speed of the LVAD.
As in you just pumped it up to get more flow.
Just like,
Let her rip.
Yeah. You'll feel better if you have more blood flow, right? So like, up it goes, you feel better. That's what we used to do. We're obviously being much more careful and much more like methodical about working out kind of what people's pressures are, what their volume is, what their echo looks like, how everything is sitting together, to try and find like the Goldilocks, both position and speed of the heart, to reduce right heart failure.
Yeah, okay. That's a really tricky problem. So you're actually using the position of the septum to dial out the speed?
Yep.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay. So I think that's all the complications I sort of had read about. Is there something that emerges I'm missing?
Nothing you're missing, but I think the one contextual thing to put into here, and it's the thing that I always have to remind my patients, is that the first generation of LVADs, median survival was 18 to 24 months, right? That's what it was. We're pretty happy. That's kind of where we got to. With the current generation of LVADs, with the most recent 5-year outcomes from the Momentum study, median survival is a little bit over 5 years. It's about 5.5 years. So it's not that these complications are new. It's not that these complications are more. It's just that people are now living long enough to have complications. And
somewhat of a sign of success of the therapy, yeah.
Exactly. Like I say to all my patients, like, the whole point of any therapy that we provide you in cardiology is that you live long enough to start having non-cardiac problems, right? Like, I stent your LAD, so you live long enough to get cancer, or you live long enough to need a hip replacement, right? That's what we do, what we do. And that's what this is. This is an extension of that, where we now, victims of our own success, where survival is so good that now no longer survival is the benchmark. The benchmark is now, how do we mitigate complications?
Morbidity, complications, yeah.
Which honestly, 5 years ago, I don't think anybody in the field would sit here and say that's where we're going to be in 5 years. But the fact is we are now, and it is remarkable. It is really special to start thinking about it. And it actually then means now I think it's really good for patients that we're starting to actually now refocus ourselves on how do we make your time on pump better rather than just keeping you alive as long as we can.
Yeah, and we certainly were guilty of that with old medicine, I guess, to just keep people alive and never think about the patient experience. So yep. It's nice to actually shift that way. So I think there's been a really interesting impact on the heart transplant waitlist, at least in America, that I had read about, that there was a change in the organ allocation system, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, where if you had a durable MCS in and things were going well, you then were decreased in priority compared to people who didn't have one and were waiting for a transplant, and that potentially led to some change in provider practice where people sort of said, well, let's not put this durable MCS in because I want this person to have a transplant. Is that what we think happened? And
it is what happened. Whether we think it or not, that's what happened. And I think it's pretty fair because you can just see across utilization of where it is what it was.
Okay.
And I think it was a necessary change in terms of the way they did the organ allocation. And I think that the effect is somewhat what they wanted. I'm not sure about all of the downstream effects that they were thinking of, but I think it's fair. And what the kind of concept was organs should always be allocated in terms of urgency of survival if you don't get that organ. Makes sense.
Sure. Yeah.
So when durable LVADs were first invented, median survival was 18 months. So they created an urgency criteria to say, okay, well, if you've had a VAD, then you have to have at least 3 months to recover after your VAD before you can put on the transplant wait list. You then, the clock starts, and you probably have about a year to get a transplant. And if you don't get your transplant within a year, you're probably going to die because
that's what
the survival says, right? Yeah. Your pump's going to fail, you'll get a clot, something like that. So they created a system initially, which was like, okay, well, we'll lump those people with everybody else that we think is probably only going to survive a year. Great. Now we know, as I just told you, people can survive up to 5 years. So they're like, well, we can't really lump them together with those people because it's not really fair. So we have to shift them and now lump them with the people that are going to survive 5 years. Now, an average heart failure person that survives 5 years is actually not that sick, right? The normal heart failure people, because, you know, median survival for heart failure, as we said, for someone on a transplant waiting list is 2 years. So you can now see if you have an LVAD therapy, you're now at a position where you're actually below basically the majority of people on the wait list. And so it then became this point where if you have someone who's quite sick and waiting for a transplant, it's do we put a VAD in? Hope that the VAD gets them to where we go. Do we use a temporary MCS device to hopefully keep them long enough to then get a VAD? And then how do we work? It has shifted one way. I think the pendulum will slowly swing back again, eventually the other direction as well. But it absolutely has happened. And it's probably one of the reasons why there's been such a shift to now the 80-20 kind of division of long-term versus short-term indication for LVAD implantation. Whereas 5 years ago, it was like 60-40. Whereas 10 years ago, it was like 50-50. Whereas previously to that, it was like 70% bridge to transplant. So as the field has evolved and the impact on the waitlist has evolved, it's sort of what has happened for patients who've got LVAD therapy.
In your experience, do you think that that was all provider-based? Like providers were saying, look, I'm not even going to put you up for a VAD. Or was it actually patients saying, well, if this is going to impair my ability to get what I view as a long-term solution, I don't want it?
No, it's all provider-based.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, it's hard for patients. One, they're quite sick. Two, it's a fairly nuanced. Like I try to be not particularly paternalistic from a perspective, but even I don't quite understand how all of the mechanics around transplant waiting lists work. And that's where you are very much dependent on your transplant director and on your surgical directors to understand that component of it. It very much came from, and it also then just was community-based, right? So when we're all a bit sheep when we do this, right, we want to make sure we're doing our best for patients. And so we follow each other. And so when you have really strong, big, influential centers with really strong, big, influential people saying, this is what we do, everybody else ends up doing the same sort of thing. Yeah. And so it creates a lot of group practice and group think that then becomes self-fulfilling, right? So if no one is putting a VAD in, then obviously the people who do end up putting a VAD in and getting a VAD do end up waiting longer because that's just the way that it works, right? And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy at some point in time.
There's so many interesting dynamics about transplant waiting lists and how you manage that and the downstream effects. It's so hard to understand.
Although very different to Australia, right? So in Australia, the transplant waiting list is not a centralized list. It's each center, each state runs their own transplant list. It is very able to be agile and you know every person on your wait list and you are able to individualize decisions based on the organ that comes out and how sick somebody is on any given day, which is not, there's not that ability in America because it's so big and there are so many people on the wait list and there are so many centers, you don't have that capability. I always remember where the first time I ever listed someone status one, which is the highest urgency you can be, right? So the first time I listed status one in America, they were listed status one. It took them, I think it took them 22 days to get a transplant, and their transplant came from, you know, four states over. So it was about, you know, about 4 or 5 hours flight away, whatever. It was a very complicated process. We had to like send a letter to UNOS, who is the central organ sharing organization. They went through all the criteria, got reviewed by a review board. It was approved, and then they were made status one. That's the process. That's how it was done. The flip side of that was the first time I've ever made someone status one in Australia. What happened then was I picked up the phone and I rang the director of transplant at every transplant program in Australia and New Zealand. I made seven phone calls. I told them the story. Everyone said, yep, sounds pretty reasonable. That person is status one. They then got offered basically every heart that came up that was available in the country that was potentially appropriate size, blood group, et cetera. And then we were able to work it that way. It's a very different sort of system. It's the same concept of you have to explain and justify why your very sick patient is sicker than everyone else's very sick patient. But just the like difference in the way that it happened and then the difference in the speed, it's just...
It reminds me of that Simpsons episode where they're in Australia and the Prime Minister's next door in the backyard drinking, you know, which is much more connected and smaller pond.
Yeah.
But it has to be one of the only places where Australia is less centralized than America. You know, that sounds a lot more like each state sort of doing its own thing, which has benefits, it seems.
It does, and I think it is. It allows the system to be a much more agile and much more patient-centric and be able to tweak it and individualize it when it's required, as opposed to in the States where because there are so many centers and so many centers that are geographically located together, right? So, you know, we have one center in Melbourne, which is a city of, you know, 5 million odd people. In where I was working in DC, it's a metropolitan area of about 5 million people. There were four transplant centers, right? Yeah. In New York, which is obviously a bigger city, there are seven transplant centers. So you need some way to standardize allocation, otherwise it just doesn't work.
Chaos in that sort of way. Yeah, okay. So what do you, if we were to take away from this podcast the role of the general cardiologist, what would you as an advanced heart failure physician like a general cardiologist to do if they see a bad patient come in under them in the hospital? I mean, presumably call you is going to be number one, but they come in under the hospital or they even come to their room somehow. What are some of the basic things that a general cardiologist can do on that front?
I mean, the biggest thing is to always treat the patient and not the... So remember that there's a patient there and think about what's going on with the patient rather than anything else. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is to always call sooner rather than later. Cool. They will always call. They will always call in advance, which is fine. So it's there. So they will always, patients will always call, but they always will have a phone number. It's usually stuck on the back of their device. It's stuck on their bag. Often they have like a wristband. We send them with those like Lance Armstrong rubber bands that have phone numbers on it. There are phone numbers everywhere. So always call. We always know. And then the last question, the last thing that I would always tell people, and I tell people all the time, is just don't be scared, right? Like it's there. It's a pump. It exists. But it's doing its job. It's really dumb in the sense that it is a not a very, it's an amazing piece of technology that is very simple, that it just is single power to keep everything moving the way that it works. And it usually will do what it needs to do. So don't get scared. Don't suddenly freak out. Don't suddenly be like, oh my God, what's going on? Just remember it's there. It's working. Work around it and get that person safely to where they need to go. And I guess lastly, which is a bit self-explanatory, you never disconnect anything. Like there are horror stories. Be a brave
cardiologist to do that.
There are horror stories. Just don't disconnect anything that's around that it's there. But don't be scared of them. And it's very easy and very simple to look after some of these patients. And you know, a lot of, you know, the future of this will be a shared combination of care where people are being looked after at both centers, right? Because there's not going to be the capacity, certainly,
to see everyone in the central center. Yeah, it sounds like a crazy model.
And also, you don't want to, right? Like, if I implant somebody who lives in Mildura, I don't want to make them come back every time they need to see me. I need somebody there who's able to manage it. And that is one thing that Australia has done very well. They have created safe decentralization of some of that basic LVAD care. So don't be scared of it. And if you're interested in it, then learn more, do more, see some of those patients.
Listen to this podcast.
Just get into it, which is great. You're already interested because you're listening, but it's certainly available for you there. But I think more importantly than that, you know, as it moves forward and we get to the point where it is going to be available, because I do strongly believe that it will get availability for long-term LVAD therapy in Australia. I think that the economics and the arguments are now strong enough that we should be there, whether it's in the next 12 months or 24 months. You know, I think it's coming. Just think about it for your patients, right? Remember that there is an alternative now. If they're not a transplant candidate and they're too old, or they're at a point where there's some reason they can't have a transplant, that doesn't just mean that they're going to die and that's the end of everything. There are alternatives for them, and there are alternatives on the pipeline. So send them down, have them refer, have them see somebody so they're in the pipeline. So when something becomes available, we can actually offer that to them rather than just have people die. It's really depressing. It was really depressing for me to work in the States and think about all of the patients in Australia who just die, when if they were in America, they would get a VAD and they would live for another 2 to 5 years.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really great message to finish on. And thank you so much, Sri, for sharing your wisdom here. I certainly learned a lot.
No worries. Thank you.